It sounds like it's almost like permission to reframe things that might have been, that you might have felt were negative in the past, but now it's like you can kind of, it sounds like you're letting yourself see it as almost like a superpower.
Or absolutely. Like, and it's something that is feeding me for some reason. Mm-hmm. Like it brings me joy. So why would I judge that?
Hi.
Hey.
Happy Thursday.
Happy Thursday. Wink. So we've talked about late blooming or the idea of, you know, coming up later in life. That was one of our first few episodes. And I have had a more recent other late blooming experience of getting an autism diagnosis. And I think if it's okay with you, I want to start with reading just the intro paragraph of an essay that I had published in a magazine called The New Quarterly.
Let's see this thing.
I'm going to lend this to you after. This is one of the copies you can borrow.
Okay.
So the essay is called In Life and Writing.
Love it.
And basically I compare the two. Okay. In many of my liberal studies courses in university, we had essays as final exams. I'd be given a series of questions to answer about a text or two passages to compare and have to come up with an essay in a few hours. I'd slowly fill up the exam booklet, and at the end, I'd write the best part of my essay condensed into one powerful sentence. This was what I'd been trying to say all along. One professor always called me out on this, circling my thesis in red and writing beside it, "This should have been at the beginning of your essay." I was frustrated by her comment because I wasn't able to write that sentence any sooner. I didn't understand my main point until I'd processed everything that came before it. As someone who came out as queer in my late 30s after marrying a man and having a child, I often feel like this late blooming essay, like I should have also known much sooner. But I couldn't or wouldn't, and so I didn't. So, yeah.
I love that. So this is from The New Quarterly, and then this is your essay titled In Life and Writing.
Yeah, it was a winter issue 173, and it was very exciting to get that published. And it was my first one in a literary magazine, but just the whole concept of like the process of writing can be where you start with an idea and you don't know where you're going to end up, or mm-hmm. you kind of think you know where you're going, but you end up somewhere else. And that whole kind of idea of either being like structured going into it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't want to be like, in the same way you don't want someone to look at your life and be like, wow, that's a mess. Like, you don't want someone to look at your essay and be like, wow, that's a mess. You know, like, where's the structure? Where's the plot? Where's the narrative?
It's the classic too of like hindsight.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Right. And so this kind of late, you know, later in life theme is just so prominent with me.
And so in the same way that in that essay you were talking about how that feedback kind of struck a nerve and hurt and all of those things. Do you have that narrative around late in life? Like, is it the same, you know, you couldn't get there anyway?
Yeah, for sure. But it does, but it doesn't mean you still don't kick yourself over it.
Yeah.
You know, often or sometimes. And actually, by the time this episode comes out, I'll have had an essay on CBC Arts coming out
mm-hmm.
about also the later in life kind of idea I write about the show Sex Education, that British show,
so
and how it brought up all these kind of later in life, these complicated later in life feelings for me, where you can feel simultaneously like grateful that the show exists, grateful that you came out when you did,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't mean that you still don't sometimes kick yourself over not knowing sooner, even though that's, you know, you couldn't have. Like, it's only yourself now who knows, who can look back and say, damn, why didn't I know? But that version of you then wasn't capable.
No, it didn't exist. And it's like the version you are now is a combination of all of those things. And I think in talking about all these versions of ourselves and kind of hitting some more intersectional identities. Maybe we should reintroduce ourselves.
Okay.
To the listeners.
Oh my God. Okay.
How do you feel about that?
Sure.
Now, you know, you're adding some letters to your with distinction.
It's true. Okay. Well, do you want to go first?
Absolutely not.
Why not?
I ask the questions here.
Okay. Okay. I'm Elena. I go by she, they, and I'm queer and I'm autistic and I'm so happy to know those things about myself now.
I love that.
Yeah.
Does it feel good to say it?
It does feel good to say it because it's also, there can be so much stigma around it and people can have certain ideas about what autism looks like as well. And which is partly why, especially as a woman or like AFABs in general, like you go under the radar because autism has been diagnosed according to male baselines.
Yep.
And
same with ADHD. Yeah. It's like, so same with most things.
Same with most things in the medical field, for sure. So yeah, people can have kind of stigma around admitting it, even because, again, people might have particular notions about what it is or what it looks like or what it means for you. And I'm just really trying to like lean into it because I know some of my quirks and strengths and some of my best qualities are probably a function of it.
Heck yeah. I love it. Yeah. Well, nice to meet you.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for meeting you.
Nice to re-meet you.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for your intro. Okay, let's see. I'm Lauren. I think we're moving into they, she.
Oh, amazing. I love this.
You know what? The she is just left for family members and colleagues.
Right. I think. It's like vestigial she. It's just kind of hanging on by a thread.
I don't need to... Yeah. We don't need to do this.
Awesome.
Yeah, neurodivergent. My usual brand is Raging ADHD.
Raging, to be just, particular.
In the positives and negatives.
Yeah.
dog mom and fiance. Mm-hmm. Creative and in my later 30s. White person.
You just can't keep going. I feel like,
any more boxes I should check?
Oh my gosh, that's so funny. That could be a whole segment. We
might have to cut this.
Yeah, maybe.
But yeah, I don't know. I think it's good to talk about the different intersecting identities because they come up in different ways. Maybe if you could talk a little bit about your diagnosis and what your journey was with that.
Sure. So actually, first it started with my daughter a couple years ago, and there was the suggestion that she might be autistic and like from the family. And I was like, no way, not a chance. Like, not at all, you know, like had no real notions of what it was or my image was probably of what it looks like in men or at boys or just like the most stereotypical versions you've seen on television or in movies. Right. And then within, I don't know, a few days of reading a bit about what it looks like in girls and women, watching a couple TED Talks and things, I was pretty convinced.
And what are some of those things?
So for girls, it's much more internalized process.
Okay.
And what you'll often see in girls is a real contrast in terms of their behavior. So like, for example, like gorgeously well-behaved at school. Every teacher is saying, what a pleasure to have in the classroom. Yeah. Loves to follow the rules, helps the other kids out, the little kids so they know what the rules are. You know, just like inquisitive, pet in the books, does what they're supposed to do. Pleasure, like absolute dream.
And you're then, like, well, I'm crushing parenting.
Yeah, but then what you see at home are the meltdowns, are the inability to sort of do things they don't want to do or I guess now in retrospect are anxious. I know they're anxious about, but it comes out as just like emotional dysregulation and like pure meltdowns and like freaking out over the tiniest little things like your socks not being perfectly aligned on your heels or my daughter had this infamous line like it's too tight and she'd kind of like pull her pants away from her body and just be like it's too tight, you know? So these like kind of bodily sensory things and just like not, like I remember the first day of school showing up for her in junior kindergarten and all the other parents and kids were like happy, taking photos, you know, just like so excited for the day. And we showed up, barely got out the door. She had cried. I had cried.
Everybody's
like,
crying.
Just barely made it there. And I remember a fellow mom being like, do you want me to take a picture of you guys? And we kind of looked up and we're like, no, like, please don't. And so things like that where you look around and you're like, why does it look like I'm the only one going through this?
Yeah.
Like, what is different about us that this was our morning, whereas everyone else had a great day?
Yeah. And it's interesting, I think you say, too, about the at home versus at school.
Yeah.
And because likely what was happening is your daughter was probably masking all day.
Totally.
And just like, you know, making it through.
Yes, making it through, trying so hard to like and know then, what the rules are, how to behave.
Yeah.
And then in the safety of home, actually just completely melting down.
Able to fall apart.
Yeah. So that was, that's one of the reasons. And then there's also part of the masking is also how like falls into people pleasing. So I mean, now that made me rethink a lot of my, what I thought was people pleasing in my life too. Cause I'm like, oh, maybe that was.
Go check out our app.
Yeah. Me masking social and just being like socialized as a girl to do these things, which are basically the same way that often girls will mask too. Yeah. Like looks very similar. And with the added social pressure of like, you know, being a girl and these kind of expectations put on you that aren't put on boys. What else was I going to say?
Well, I think even too, to the looking back, like I think we talked a little bit about this with coming out and it's like, it's so interesting because it's now that you have this diagnosis and understanding and framework, it's like, it's so tempting and like, how can you not look back and try and be like, pick up on those things?
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then once she was diagnosed, well, as she was getting diagnosed, basically, it started me thinking about myself and just being like, well, there are some parallels there. Like, I remember being inconsolable, my mom's words exactly, you know, when I had to go to, like, swimming lessons. Probably every week I cried or, like, you know, and...
And what was it about the swimming lessons?
I don't remember. I literally just remember just being, like, so upset.
Yeah.
And but anything she kind of was making me do... or anything I didn't want to do. One time she literally had, I remember holding on to my bed at home.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to go to school. I think this was like JK or something, very little. Oh yeah, so basically, I think it was junior kindergarten. I remember holding on to my bed and crying. My mom had to like call my dad home from work to help to try and get me there. And it's supposed to be only half days.
Yeah.
And apparently, I just learned this recently, that it just happened so many times that I do remember being sat down beside my teacher and just crying and her like patting me on the head. But it happened so much that the school eventually was like, you know what? Let's just try again next year. Like this clearly isn't working.
Like you just.
I just didn't go.
No more JK.
Just no. We'll try again next year. Right.
And it's so, like they're clearly not ready.
Yeah. But then part of the diagnosis was like going back and luckily my mom had kept all my report cards from literally every year and including a letter from my Montessori school that was so, it was just basically an echo of of my daughter's behavior, like perfect, a dream in the class, follows the rules. And then meanwhile at home, I'm melting
hanging
down,
onto
right?
the bed, yeah. headboard.
And yeah, exactly. Right. So that's one clear sign. There's also like more subtle things, like apparently autistic girls are more likely to have boys as friends when they're younger. And my daughter did that. I still have a lot of close guy friends because there's this kind of well, maybe not a lot, too. I have like two and I love them both, but there's this, it just feels like a simpler interaction for you. It's like a less complicated dynamic and relationship. And so my daughter had that as well when she was little. So anyways, I'm getting off topic, but her diagnosis led to me considering my own experience. And then, and it was also happening at a point where I was feeling like suddenly most functioning and relationships and things were suddenly just more difficult and I couldn't understand why.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, in retrospect, I think I was going through autistic burnout, really. But so it kind of was like at the same time as me reaching some sort of breaking point, mm-hmm. where I was already kind of, you know, looking at what was going on. So that made sense of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so in since being diagnosed and now knowing what you know now and having this new lens to look back on your experiences, what's happened since your diagnosis? Are there new ways you're kind of dealing with things? What's going on?
I think it's a whole new level of permission, basically, at its core. It's like permission to say no to things, permission to protect my energy,
mm-hmm.
You know, like permission to even just silly things that save me, like not silly things, but I didn't realize how much joy I get from leftovers.
Amazing.
Like from making a lot of food,
yeah.
and knowing it's going to save me energy for like the next few days.
Yeah.
I get so much happiness out of that.
Yeah. Didn't we talk, we've talked, I think, on the podcast before too, about like permission to just even eat the same thing.
Totally. Yeah. Oh yeah. Maybe that was when we did a New Year's
episode. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, yeah,
so you're following your resolutions. Definitely. Look at us checking
yeah.
in.
Yeah. And I'm learning two things that feed me. Like, so when I am having, well, there was one huge revelation that, another common experience mm-hmm. of autistic women is misdiagnosis.
Yeah.
And a psychologist did try to diagnose me with depression and it didn't feel right. Cause I was like, but it's not chronic for me. Like I can be great for days and days and then I'll have two sad days where I can't do anything. And
that's burnout.
Yeah. That's the burnout. And so I realized that actually my sad is when I'm tired.
Mm.
That's when it happens. So just like knowing that it's a temporary state, if I can try and avoid it, then that's great.
And then just even maybe prioritizing sleep and the things that affect your sleep.
Totally. Rest. Yeah. And then also what I realized, because you don't want to just necessarily like rest all the time during those moments. So actually what I found I did last time was I did some like baking and cooking.
Oh, yeah.
And it was just like slow and quiet.
Permission.
But yeah. And like the smell of the broth I'm making soup and baking stuff, like kind of meditative, you
That's
know?
Awesome.
And so I was like, oh, this is me actually kind of filling my cup a little again.
This is what I do in those kind of slow. And even I think too, it's interesting that from what you're saying, there's a lot of like, oh, it seems like there's a bit of a Venn diagram with ADHD, because I was diagnosed with depression as a teenager, and in my early 20s, and I've recontextualized a lot of that to be with more of like, you know, that ADHD burnout, and so it's really cool to hear you say that, but I think it's what I was gonna say. Oh, where was it going? That like permission to slow down and just being like, oh, I've been here before. I know what works in these moments.
Yeah.
That's so great. I think even just like riding the different waves and energies that we have is a skill, regardless of whether or not you're neurodivergent, is something that's really valuable for a lot of people and like being okay with it.
Yeah, exactly. Not like judging yourself for
it. Yeah, because that only makes it, it's like there's already so much pressure and
What else was I going to say about that? And even just other sensory things like lighting candles or listening to particular music, even if it's the same album over and over and over again, like if that's what feeds you again and if that's what kind of builds you back up, then just like lean into it. So the kind of like nerding out that mm-hmm. can happen with autism, you can be like, you know, just really be fascinated by something and just allowing myself to lean into that, like whether it's my writing or just like, I don't even know, random things.
It sounds like it's almost like permission to reframe things that you might have felt were negative in the past, but now it's like you can kind of, it sounds like you're letting yourself see it as almost like a superpower. Or
absolutely.
Like,
and it's something that is feeding me for some reason, mm-hmm. like it brings me joy. So why would I judge that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm curious, because obviously you're a professor, you're a writer. We just listened to one of your published essays. I think it's, and I'm curious if you would make the comparison, but I think there's definitely something to the sensory things, and that probably being a really big part of your writing. It's like, because if you are someone who is really sensitive to the way something feels, or like, you know, the smell of the rain or the candles or this, it's like you're probably, I would imagine, more easily able to paint those pictures for other folks.
That's a good point. I think part of it for me is maybe it's like the pattern noticing almost.
Yeah.
Or finding some bigger meaning in a moment.
Yeah.
Like, I think I told you about this essay that I've written called The Card Aisle, where it's about, like, basically it opens with me trying to pick a card, a Mother's Day card, and that experience, you know, being basically like a moment of truth for you. It's this moment that forces you to define a relationship. And, you know, like, sometimes you're simplifying the relationship. Sometimes you're speaking neutrally. Sometimes you're imposing your own personality on the other person with the card you give. Sometimes, like, there's all these different things that come from that. And that's one of those thoughts that, you know, anyone I tell, they're like, oh, absolutely. Like, I've experienced that. Like, but yet it's, I don't know, maybe
they might not articulate it.
Yeah, exactly. Or have thought of it
or
that
have
way.
Like lived in it in the same way.
Yeah. So for me to like find those moments that feel like a microcosm for something bigger that we experience, I feel like that is the strength too that probably comes from.
It's the end of the essay. It's like the sum up.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's what makes like even things as simple as TikToks or Instagrams. It's when someone articulates the obvious thing. I don't have that ability in the same way. It's like, I love your writing because you always have this like hook or way in that's so evident after you've read it, but like not until then.
Right.
And I think because you're living in those nuances so much more, you're more easily able to access those, which is really cool.
I mean, I think writing has been a gift to put me in touch with my more like emotive side, because probably also part of my autism has meant I've thought about my feelings more than I felt them in the past.
Ooh, yeah.
And not articulated them, not been able to identify them really, not be able to be in my like embodied with them.
And it's like been more part intellectual. Of the
whole, exactly. Yeah. And so I think this whole like, you know, spiritual journey I've been on for however many years, it all began with you.
Don't
know,
throw it away.
I know, but you know, but I mean, it's been, that's when I started writing.
Yeah.
Was through getting in touch with that and kind of finally opening up that portal of emotions that was like corked for so long.
Yeah.
And so I think the writing lets me kind of pair those two, where it's like, it's analytical in a certain way, but it's also emotional.
So question for our listeners who might themselves be autistic, or some of these themes might even just be resonating for them. They may not have a diagnosis, and we can talk about diagnosis, and there's, you know, it's not always necessary. but what do you do? I'm curious about like when you're first meeting people and like just getting to know folks, do you lead with, do you tell people, or do you have any kind of strategies that you've kind of maybe learned recently or have noticed that you have employed in the past when meeting other folks?
I mean, I guess it depends on like, I'm not likely just going to be throwing it out.
Yeah.
To random strangers, unless it comes up in the context of some sort of conversation.
Well, and I guess too, like you're not someone who ticks or like has visual presentations of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I might, you know, let's say though, if I'm out at a place that's pretty busy and I'm trying to talk to someone and it's sensory overload, then I might bring it up and be like, oh, could we go over there? Or I have to put some earplugs in. In context, I might bring it up.
Yeah.
But I mean, who knows? Sometimes maybe I would bring it up in some random way too, as part of my autism. just be like, well, just kind of as a throwaway comment, maybe
try to get ahead of it. Or
yeah, I mean, but at the same time, it's not necessary. But it could also be, you know, when I probably bring it up, is if I think I've developed a bit of, like, in the same way you develop gaydar,
mm-hmm.
like an autism radar.
Totally.
So I feel like I probably would bring it up if I suspected that they might also be autistic if on the spectrum somewhere.
If you're out at a show and you're two people in the booth while everyone else is on the dance floor.
Yeah. If we're in our introverts corner, if we're both putting our earplugs in at the same moment.
Yeah. What a fun meet cute. You look over, you're putting your earplugs in.
Oh,
hey.
Okay, I like that.
Okay,
that's... another thing I wanted to mention is leaning into alone time and just, like, I don't think I've ever celebrated alone time as much as I do now. Yeah. I used to maybe judge myself for wanting it or think that I should be, like, you know, with people. There's oftentimes I'll be out at a coffee shop on my own and I'll look up and I'm like, most other people here are here with other people and they're all chatting and I'm okay with that. Like, yeah. I'll almost have a moment to be like, wait, is this weird that I'm just here alone? And then be like, nah, you know,
it's fine.
Because and half the time I end up talking with people. Yeah. There's, you know, it ends up being social, but it's also almost like I'd like being around people, but not having the responsibility of the other people sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
And so you're just like people watching. You can, you know, pipe in if you want to here and there, but it's kind of all up to you. Like, you have agency in that moment. And so yeah, I've never celebrated alone time so much because I really feel like, at least in my experience, it is like, that's when I recharge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how I feel like group running. I want there to be people who are talking. I don't want to talk. I'm too tired. I'm running. I'm just focusing on getting wherever the heck we're going and not dying.
Yeah. But you want the...
But I want to be in the conversation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And to like be a part of it, but I don't want to contribute.
It's so funny. Just leeching off their conversation.
Yeah, I think I must listen to too many podcasts. I'm just like, tell me a story.
Give me a podcast in my ears right now.
Yeah.
It's so funny.
Resources or like maybe if just like
I can post we can add the place that I got diagnosed if anyone wants because they'll do diagnoses for people that aren't children, and it's really a combination of a qualitative interview where you answer a bunch of questions about your experience, and then you also afterwards fill out a bunch of quantitative questionnaires which are all help in their diagnosis. And then just like a kind of a debrief afterwards to tell you where you landed potentially on the spectrum. And yeah, I mean, I don't think I realized how powerful the diagnosis would be. I definitely did cry, you know, when they told me, because there is also obviously grief that comes along with not understanding your own experience for so many years of your life. And, you know, you kind of feel sad for that kid who was like, oh, that's why she didn't get it. Or that's why that was so confusing, you know? So that's normal to have feelings like that. And, you know, you can go between feeling great for knowing, but also feeling sad for not having known for so long.
Totally.
But yeah, if anyone's curious, and you don't have to even go through diagnosis, we will post a couple resources, including where I got my diagnosis, and Devin Price writes pretty extensively about it, and we can post. He has one book as well that's basically arguing that you don't ever have to go through an official diagnosis, like self-diagnosis is enough. And there's so many resources out there too that we can post some for you if you're interested.
I love it. Thank you so much for sharing, your experience with all of us. It's been cool to be, you know, a passenger on your journey.
Yeah. Well, I love having you there.
This has been another episode of Dear Queer. Just a reminder, we are not actually experts. Any advice given should actually come from our experts who we will bring in from time to time. Music brought to you by Sean Patrick Brennan, produced by myself, Lauren Hogarth, and your host, as always, Elena Papianis. I'm getting that.